This is Faster, a podcast by Flow Cycling. In each episode, we interview industry experts to educate you, challenge you, and even change the way you train so you become faster. Champions, how are they made? If you ask the likes of Lance Armstrong, Tiger Woods, and Maria Sharapova, Dr. Jeff Spencer has that answer. Jeff, a former U.S. Olympic cyclist, used his knowledge and experience to start coaching elite performers to perform at their highest potential. Today on Faster, we talk with the cornerman to gain his insight on the champion's mindset, setting goals, building a solid team, the steps to success, and overcoming roadblocks. If you take his advice, you just may change your habits and strengthen your mind to perform at the height of your game so you can become faster. When we're not creating this podcast, we're working on other ways to make you faster. At Flow, we design and manufacture some of the world's fastest cycling wheels that we sell consumer direct to keep more money in your pockets. As a special thank you for listening to Faster, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase. Simply use coupon code PODCAST in all capital letters at checkout. Your purchase will also support our give back initiatives. 1% of all sales supports our Bike for a Kid program, where we provide bikes and helmets for kids in need. We also plant one tree for every wheel we ship as a thank you to our planet. Enjoy the show. Dr. Jeff Spencer, welcome to the Faster Podcast. How are you doing today?
Hey, John. Just couldn't be better. An opportunity to share what I know with others. And so thanks again for the invite.
No, we're thrilled to have you on. We were just talking here just before this started, and I was mentioning that I heard about you on another podcast, a guy named Jim Quick, who's does some really cool stuff with memory stuff, and it's what a small world you're on there. And I'm hearing some of the people that you've worked with in the past, Lance Armstrong, Tiger Woods. I mean, your list is quite impressive. So of course I looked you up, I listened to your podcast and was just fascinated and wanted to get you on the show and thought you'd be a great addition for our listeners here. And so I really appreciate your time coming on.
Well, thank you.
Excellent. So let's get started. Let's just get a quick version of your story and sort of how you got started and you know what your background is.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was seven, I wanted to become an Olympian. I thought that'd be cool. I didn't know how I was going to do it. But when I was 10, I showed some very precocious ability on a bicycle. I kind of figured out, well, maybe this is the way I'm going to do it. And I was fortunate to have had an angel come into my life. He was a five-time national champion and three-time Olympic cyclist, and he took me under his wing and he showed me how to win. He said, you know, you're going to be a great cyclist by learning how to win. It's a learned skill, and trying harder and having talent plays a role in it, but you have to understand what it takes to really make it happen. So I was very fortunate to have the ability to absorb and take on that level of guidance. And it was a kind of a 10-year journey from 10 to 11 to 21. And when I was 18, just kind of with a couple of years to go to hopefully get a berth on the Munich Olympic team, I met my second angel, who was somebody that came into my life, because last time I saw my dad when I was 13, so I was basically on my own and needed really solid guidance, and I had the ability to absorb that and take it and apply it. I have a self-starting gene. I don't need motivation from anybody. And my second mentor helped sculpt my mind. He was a true Renaissance man, and he actually chose me to be his apprentice to help him craft his art glass masterpieces. So that was an unlikely pairing, but there was something there that he saw. And the goal for me was it crafted and pulled out of me an artistic side, and he would play classical music to me at lunch. He would read the great philosophers to me. He would share the playwrights and this whole kind of genre of life experience that I had the capacity to absorb, but I certainly didn't get it from my family, you know, or the athletic community. So we kind of wrap all that up together. And when I was between my sophomore and junior year at USC, where I was studying sports science as a scholarship student, that's when I did become an Olympian and competed in the Munich Olympics. And then I went on to get my master's degree. And with my experience in the Olympics and my knowledge of the body, business people came to me that wanted to become their own champions, and athletes came that wanted to win gold medals and make a bunch of money as professional athletes. And I knew how to do that because of my experience. And then there was a kind of a twist of fate here where the athlete said, I need to extend my careers, and the best way to do that is to prevent injuries or come back quickly from them. And the business people said, well, look, I don't want to die like I see my same age counterparts dying of heart attacks in the early 40s. Can you help me not do that? So I went back to school and I got my licensure to be a primary healthcare provider to help them with how do you get well and stay well and how do you stay in the game over the long term and how do you believe and know the evidence that you can push when you got to push and stay in the game to create and amass your best legacy possible. So what happened from that is that people in all disciplines saw that I was like a one-stop Jiffy Lube shopping center where you could go in and kind of get everything done simultaneously, like in one guy. You know, you didn't need 10 experts that weren't talking to each other, each giving the person that they were advising their maximum program that was not possible to do because it was too extensive. So that's kind of how I got on the map. And, you know, people that play a really big game, they don't have a lot of time and they're looking for value and economy in accuracy of input. And so that's how I got to work with U2 and help them prepare for World Tour. That's how I was able to do 9 Tour de France's in an advisory capacity, boots on the ground in France, and how I could spend time on Richard Branson's island with him and other entrepreneurs. So it became more of a skill set of not technical things to do, but how do you show up and what decisions that you need to make sure that you are prepared to do what has to go right when it has to go right to create the most significant number and magnitudes of life successes. So that's basically the script from then to now. And then one other thing I'll add, I think this is really important, is that 11 years ago, we adopted our daughter from Colombia at the age of 10. It was a very unusual adoption because most kids are considered damaged goods. And we had a calling to do it and we did it. But I quickly realized that since she didn't speak English, we didn't speak Spanish, she had no school, parasitic ridden body, ADHD, PTSD, every known risk factor for a life gone wrong. She had a 20 on a scale of 10 for everything. I realized that, you know, I cannot continue to have the volume that my career currently is to be her father. So I cut out 90% of my professional life at that time when I was at the height of my career to raise her as her father. I was still practicing at the time, but that probably taught me more than anything that I've ever learned in terms of the nuances of life. And, you know, how do you tease out the rarefied percentages of performance that is the home court advantage, should I say? And I learned a lot from that experience. So I am back in the game full blast like right now. So that's where I came from. And that was a kind of a 60-year journey, just said in a couple of minutes.
That's, I got to say, that's one of the most unique, diverse, interesting, impressive intros I think we've ever had on the show. I mean, that's, you're like a, you were saying you met a Renaissance man. I think you're the Renaissance man at this point. That's a pretty cool story.
Well, thank you. It's been a blessing. Yeah.
Perfect. So I think before, like, we want to talk about the champion's mindset a little bit. And I think most people think of a traditional coach, especially if you're looking at cycling or endurance sports, is somebody who is putting together plans and programs. You know, you're going to put an interval here or do that. How do you sort of define, if you had to sum it up almost in like a sentence, what is it you do as a coach for somebody?
Let me distinguish something I think is really important, if I can use 2 minutes instead of one here, is that there are different types of advisors. You can have a coach that's an expert in a technical area, which is like one slice of the pie, but it's not the whole pie. And then you have a mentor that could help you in maybe half the pie, but both of them don't know the pie taken as a whole. And so anytime we're talking about crafting an individual capacity to perform at the best, decisions have to be made against the whole. So there's this rarefied, unique species I call the corner man that has a lot of skin in the game. They're older. There's nothing that they haven't seen in life. Where Rocky had Mickey, the old guy in his corner, who was reading in real time what the context of Rocky's life was and what decisions to make then to avoid preventable problems and seize and capitalize on best opportunities. And that's really what I do. I work on the individual as a living, breathing entity that has to make consistent, good decisions by reading the terrain correctly, all things considered, to make the best choices to get as much life progress is possible in the least time with least effort. And that's what I do. We look under each rock to make sure we see everything that's there. We have no illusions. And then we craft a process to take them forward. There are four things I do. First of all, I get the data. I got to know everything about that individual so I understand their entire universe. The A in DARE stands for analyze, and I take a look at it. You know, what does all this mean? You know, where are you? And because of where you are, what do we do with that? And then I create their personal roadmap from how to get from where they are to where we want to go. And then we execute that, you know, very vigorously, and we adapt appropriately and route from where we are to where we want to go. That's what I do.
That's awesome. And thank you for specifying that in the beginning here, because I think it's going to help with a lot of these other questions. So let's look at the champion's mindset. Let's assume that somebody wants to become a champion. How do they learn how to set a goal that's within their reach and that utilizes their unique talents and gifts?
Well, I think the first thing is to look at the idea of mind, because everything kind of does start with mind. But in my mind, no pun intended, it's extremely important that when we talk about mindset, most people think, well, I'm just going to mow anything down because nothing's going to get in my way. I'm strong-willed in what I see I'm going to achieve by virtue of the fact that I want it. And there's a lot of people that got a lot of will and a lot of talent that don't go anywhere. And it's not because they don't have will and talent, but they don't have a model and they don't understand the difference between the human mindset and their human nature and their champion's mind and their champion's nature. And to me, we really have to understand that we have two forces within us. We have two mentalities that are simultaneously at war with each other for control over our thinking and our decision-making. And this is a 24-hour-a-day battle that we all experience at some level of uneasiness just about the life process and where we are and what's coming. And when we look at the human mindset, this is really human nature. You know, we all have a way of thinking that's common to us that we call human nature. And our fear-based human nature response to life is hair trigger. It's faster than we can think, and it's only about survival. And if you make your decisions out of survival only, well, then don't plan on having a life of excellence, because you're making decisions not with the idea of creating excellence, but you're making the decisions out of being safe and out of avoiding catastrophe. And because that side of us gets first dibs at every moment, and what do I mean by that? I actually was helping an athlete win a gold medal because he was mentally locked up because he was coming from this human mindset. He was making all of his decisions out of what he stood to lose. He was making all of his decisions out of the fear of what could happen. You know, champions don't do that. You know, they make their decisions out of what they stand to gain. Completely different world. And I told him that, you know, he thought that he needed to be perfect to win a gold medal. And I said, well, that's mythology. That's human nature. That's not necessarily true. And you guys think that the way you're going to win a gold medal is that if you have a contingency for everything that could go wrong, for all the details, then you put in the perfect jump and win. But your mind's going to play a trick on you. It's going to make you think that there's another detail that you need to find to be capable of winning. Therefore, you've invested 100% of your confidence in the one thing you can't find and never will find. Therefore, you've already lost. I said, champions don't do that. You know, they look at the one or two things that have to go right. And as long as you're looking at the one or two things that have to go right, then you're going to win. And for you to win the gold medal in 2 weeks' time is that you have to make sure that you don't change your warm-up. Don't screw around with it. When you do the warm-up correctly, it tells your body that you're ready to jump. It wants to come out and win for you. Give it a chance to do that. I said, the second thing is just get the first four steps to your run-up to make sure your foot hits the board to get the lift to win the gold medal. Boom. That's all you need to do, and you're going to win the gold medal. And he did. 2 weeks later, boom, Preston, instant gold medal. So we got to be really careful that we're told that our first impulse is always the thing to follow. And I'm saying I'm not so sure about that. I think that's mythology, because if what we're telling ourselves to be true is based on a survival reflex that's not geared towards excellence, then don't plan on winning. And I see this happen all the time with people. Like, Jeff, can you give me a couple of examples of this? Yeah, I can, as a matter of fact. It's like, have you ever slipped on ice and your hand knows exactly where to put itself to break the fall, but it was faster than you could think? I mean, clearly something else was there to help support and protect you from injury. And likewise, if there's an example from human interaction, have you ever said anything to anybody that felt really good when you were thinking about saying it and it came out of your mouth faster than you can think? And once you got it out, you realized that was really a stupid thing to say. Why did I do that? Well, I'm sure, you know, you wouldn't do that, of course, but just for those that we know who have, we can say, well, where did that come from? Well, that's a good question. It came from your survival instinct, you know? So again, let's not come from that. So the champion's mind, and we have the human nature mindset that's fixed, and those are always at war with us. So I have a whole model devoted to that, but just to say that the winning mind comes from the champion that makes decisions out of what you stand to gain, not what you stand to lose, rather than saying, I'm doing my best, it's like I'll find a way. Rather than saying it's about perfection, it's about the one or two things that have to go right. So I want to make that really clear to people that we do have two mentalities that are working side by side. One is not in our best interest, the prosperity. The other one is in our best interest. And as long as we learn how to read that, then we can make really good decisions and move forward. So to answer the second question, if I may, unless you'd like to elaborate on what I just said there, but as far as the goal, you know, there's all sorts of goals out there. There's small goals, there's big goals, there's big, hairy, audacious goals, there's smart goals. But to me, the most important goal to have is the right goal. And when I talk about the right goal, there's actually a model that each of the letters in the word right stands for something that should be part of the goals that we decide to engage in. Number one, the R in right stands for relevant. Like, why is this goal relevant to me? Because if it's relevant to you, then it's probably close to a right goal. The I in right stands for indicators. What are the indicators to me that this is the right goal for me? Well, my mind likes the idea because it's an intellectual reach. I feel excited about it because I'm going to learn something. It's going to raise my bar. For the body, it may be something that challenges the body appropriately to build a better, more highly functioning body. You feel that because you're energized about it. And the soul feels that there's enough humanity in the goal that you're inspired to pursue it. So those are all really good signs. The G in right is gravity. Like, what's the emotional attachment between you and the goal? And if you can name that emotional attachment and you feel a calling to it, then again, it's probably the right goal. The H in right stands for height. Is it the right altitude? Is there enough reach for you that this would be a statement about you? Would this allow you to confirm that you're capable of what you think you're capable of? If it is, then you probably got the right altitude and the right goal. And then finally, the T in right is time. It's just the right time to pursue the goal. Do you have the time to do it? And is the timeline from now to goal completion, is that acceptable to you? And if you answer yes to 85 or 90% of that, then it's probably the right goal to pursue, and you'll have a much better relationship with it because you took the time to thoroughly vet the goal. Most people don't do that. They're only looking at what is the goal going to give me once it's complete. They don't have a relationship with the goal. It's only about, again, the new car, the new house, or the new whatever. So I feel like for those highly aspirational goals, it's really critical that we develop a very in-depth, passionate relationship with the goal itself, by using the right goal criteria.
That's awesome. So let's say we finally figured out what our goal is, you know, it follows that right concept. How do you go about starting each day to achieve that goal?
Well, I think you start the day before. At the end of the workday, the day before, you take a look at what you've got accomplished that you never need to look at again. And then you make a list of those things that need yet to get done, and you know exactly what you need to do and where to start on those. And then you make another list of projects that need to get completed, but you're not quite sure what to do. And so the next day you get up because you already know what you're going to do. You don't decide on the day that you're going to do something, decide what it is, because it's too late. You know, you need time to do that in advance. So when you show up the next day, you've already got what's in front of you. You know exactly what you need to do. If you need to modify it a little bit, you could have done that later in the evening, or you could have done it the morning of. And that way your mind, body, and soul are already anchored and prepared to be able to engage in something where you're not intimidated by it, because you've already given some thought as to how you're going to do it and how you're going to execute it. It's a much easier way of keeping track of things, and you show up a lot more prepared.
One of the things you talked about in your podcast was using the concept of purpose to help you in achieving your goals. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, all of us need a certain extra energy sources in any aspirational goal, because goals of significance always have, you know, unanticipated points of difficulty. And why purpose is important to me is that it gives us an ability to commit to beginning and finishing something. And that's why purpose is important. And purpose is really related to goal impact. So if you understand the impact of your goal on yourself, on your legacy, on other people in the world around you, because you've thoughtfully considered that, then it gives you a deeper sense of purpose to be able to show up and get the job done. If we don't have that, we're more likely to stall, or perhaps even worse yet, when things get difficult, abandon ship on the goal itself.
You know, most of our listeners are competitive cyclists or triathletes and people in that realm. And I know you've worked with some, you know, pretty amazing cyclists over the years. So what would be a goal, and maybe if you give an example for a triathlete or cyclist that you would potentially set with somebody if they were to work with you?
Well, I think it's got to be highly aspirational, first and foremost, and it has to be outside their reach, because generally things that are outside our reach, we can actually do, but we just don't think that we can because we've never done it yet. And so based upon the ability and where a person is in their career development, you would pick an aspirational goal that they're excited about, but they're also a little bit intimidated by. Because if you're achieving all your goals and all the goals are set a little bit too low, and if that's the case, then we're not really growing and developing confidence in ourselves. So let's say, for example, you know, a client, Gavin Hoover, who I helped make the Olympic team last year, you know, one of our goals was not necessarily to win certain things, but to improve the quality of his ability to respond to changes in schedule. Because in my opinion, you should be able to adjust and step up and perform any place, any time under any given set of circumstances. And to do that, you really have to train your mind, and you have to have meticulous approach to your training to make sure that in times of stress, you don't crack and revert back to previous behavior that didn't serve you well at the time, and it's not going to serve you well now. So in Gavin's situation, we were able to do that successfully, and he was able to capitalize on some opportunities that most people would have bungled.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. Another thing I really like that you do, you talk about is, you know, you talked a little bit in the beginning about the idea of having two minds, one being from fear or anxiety or worry. And, you know, you want to try and keep yourself in a present state. One of the things about being present, it also allows you to sort of let go of the ego that you have that can get in the way of pursuing a goal where you're thinking, you know, from an egoic mindset. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you help people, you know, stay humble in the process of while trying to achieve greatness?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, you know, number one, we need to look at the fact that anytime we have an opportunity to pursue something, that's a gift. And we need to honor that gift by developing our talents, in my opinion, to be able to showcase our appreciation for that. And I feel that, you know, nobody is entitled to anything. I think it's through the merits of your own ingenuity and your own creativity. And that's the reason why you're given those assets, is to find a way to the promised land, whatever that is. And you can think whatever you want, but if it's not what it is, then it's still not what it is. And I feel that people really need to assume accountability for their choices and for their ability to adapt and avoid preventable problems and seize best opportunities. And the ego, the entitlement of that, or the inability or unwillingness to face oneself, if someone has that, then they're going to be severely restricted in their ability to perform at their highest level. So again, a bit of advice that one athlete told me once. He said, you know, Jeff, the worst mistake I ever made was the first excuse I ever made. He said, because when I made my first excuse, it just got easier and easier to make the excuses. And I basically threw away my career, you know, what I could have potentially done, because I've done that. So I think that, you know, again, we have to be willing to face our own reluctance to admit or come face to face with our liabilities and those things that don't work for us. But, you know, the champions know that you build a career based on your strengths, as well as trying to uplift some of the liabilities. But for sure, when we're pursuing our strengths because we're aware of what those are, and we're compliant with showing up every day faithfully to do what has to go right to move forward, then we learn the skill to be able to stay in the game long enough to overcome any obstacle to eventually find ourselves in the winner's circle.
I love that. And another thing you talked about in your intro actually was, you know, so you had a lot of teammates and people on your team that helped you accomplish getting to the Olympics and not only your professional career. And there is a strength of your team that helps a lot of champions get there. So how is it that you can learn to rely on others to help you accomplish your goals?
It really begins with understanding what your strengths and weaknesses are. And first off, one of the axioms of greatness is that no one wins alone. It's not possible. Right. Nobody knows enough, has enough energy and time to do what's required to create greatness. And when we flow power to others to do things for us that we can't do for ourselves, it creates one of the most extraordinary human experiences ever, which is called a group win. I don't think there's anything better than that. You know, we won those 8 Tour de France's that I was involved in. It was totally a team effort. So again, a couple things about team is that looking for and assembling a team is actually a sign of strength. It's not a sign or an admission of weakness or inability to do something. It's a sign of great leadership. As we assemble our team, make sure that we get the most qualified people possible. You know, if you need to spend a little bit more time and resources on getting a better person, get the best person that you could find. Another aspect to teammates is to make sure that teammates are honored. You know, when we did those Tour de France's, the team leader, you know, Lance, I mean, he would always go and thank all the riders every night for what they did for him. And he would always let them go and precede him with regard to getting massages, getting all the other stuff, because he realized that without the team, it would be impossible to win because, again, like no one wins alone.
Exactly. No, that's true. Nobody does win alone. You know, there's always somebody that helps you on your journey on the way. And a lot of times some of the goals, when it's not team related, if it's an individual pursuit, you know, you have a team that is in some ways acting a little selflessly to help you. So how can you ensure that you're also serving those around you when it's more of an individual pursuit?
Well, first off, in the process of preparing for the event itself, you continually and continuously give thanks to people for even the smallest things, and you honor them by showing up on time. Nothing's more disrespectful than to keep someone that's helping you waiting, and that's a sign that you care and that you acknowledge them. It helps also to publicly call them out when you get a chance to do that. You pay honor to your team first, and then another thing I'll say about this is that one of the highest honors that anybody can do to say thank you, whether it's family, friends, benefactor, or mentor, is to win. Because every time you win, that's really saying thank you to those that have helped us. And, you know, some people feel like, well, isn't it just a bit self-serving to do that? I say, no, it's just exactly the opposite, is that when you're showcasing your talents, you're not only honoring your past through this dimension, and you're also honoring your gifts, which, as I tell my daughter, you know, we have a moral obligation to honor our gifts, to be the best that we can be, to honor that. You know, and if you turn your back on that, you're turning your back on one of the reasons why you're here on this planet. And another reason why this is important is because, like, every time you succeed, you're demonstrating for other people what's possible. And there's every time in human history where we need living, breathing examples of people that can fight the honorable fight to get beyond their own limitations and the boogeyman inside their head, then it becomes more believable that other people, since someone else has done it, that they can do it. So we, in my opinion, do have an obligation to showcase to others what is possible through our example.
You told the story in one of your podcasts that I thought was, number one, I just thought it was really cool that you remembered it. There was this, you said there was an older lady in the area that you lived before you were going to the Olympics, and she gave you $25 before you went to the Olympics. What kind of struck me about that was a little bit remarkable is that some people probably wouldn't remember that because $25 really isn't that significant. But to her, it was probably something, you know, a huge thing. But you've remembered that, and you considered her as part of your team. You know, you've kind of, you know, we all are kind of one on this planet. And the way that you described that, I just thought that was a really cool way to do that. And, you know, you're saying by winning, in some way, you've honored her and her $25 of her hard-earned money to help you get there.
Yeah, very, 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 very much so. And I think we actually need to be consciously looking for opportunities to do this. And be mindful that without the graceful support of other people, there's no way that we would ever be able to tap into anything close to our potential. And I feel that we need to designate and set aside purposeful and deliberate time to make sure that we contact people, because a lot of times people will say, well, it goes without saying, but I honestly think that it should be said. And especially in today's world, that couldn't become, you know, more impersonal to go that extra distance, because, you know, we meet the same people on the way up as we do on the way down. And you just kind of never know what's around the next corner. And, you know, I was dying from mercury poisoning 20 years ago. And, you know, when I felt my life force leaving my body, you know, I realized that the only thing I was going to be remembered by is what I gave people. And the only thing that I was going to take with me is what I did. And I feel that if we show goodwill towards people, then more goodwill will come. And we shouldn't do it for that reason, but we should do it because it's the right thing and the fair thing to do.
I love that. I love that. Let's assume that we have somebody on our team that's not pulling the weight. You know, sometimes, you know, if the fit's not right for you, it may not be right for them as well. What are your recommendations for dealing with teammates that maybe aren't their best fit?
Well, if it's a maybe and you're not sure, then they need to be tested. And my kind of always first take on this is that if you sense something's there, believe it is there, and don't discount what you may be seeing. A lot of people may say, well, you know, you're being too judgmental, or give them a chance or whatever, but that never works out well. You know, there's always premonitions of things to come, and we never, of course, you know, hold out the possibility of a change, and it isn't what we think it is. But I think that we need to make sure, if we have a suspicion about something, that we create a task for the individual to demonstrate which it is it or is it not? And based upon that, if it's a not, then kind of take it as a not, and also be mindful at a certain point, more conversation is not going to solve the problem. It's just an incompatibility. There's no judgment attached to it, but at that point, probably what our aspirations are aren't well suited to the individual, and it's going to be painful either way. If you don't do anything, it's going to be a slow pain indefinitely, and if you do have to terminate and shift gears, then there's be a little bit of a sting. But if it's an inevitability, it's always better to do it sooner than later than have it be a prolonged issue that has no redemption in the first place.
Yeah. And as humans, you know, we all go through, you know, ups and downs on our own. And, you know, at some points, you know, we're probably not doing our best. Maybe we're not showing up each day and pulling our weight the way that we need to be. What are your recommendations if you find yourself in a slump and you have a team that's, you know, there for you?
You mean as a leader and you're in a slump as a leader? Or
exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we actually had that at one of the tours. You know, it's Lance, you know, he was 10% off. And he said, Jeff, I don't know what to do about this. It's like, I'm 10% off. It's just not there. I don't know what to do about this. You know, and it's like, he said, the hardest thing ever was for me to go down and have to have and eat dinner and breakfast with the team knowing that I couldn't deliver. So it's the hardest thing in my entire life to do that, because these guys have given me everything and I cannot deliver on my side of the bargain right now. And a couple things here. Number one, the teammates would come to me, hey, how is he? You know, I say, he's okay. But the solution to this was a really important take home is that, you know, when we find ourselves in a slump, we don't start looking for magic potions, you know, magic vitamins. We don't start looking for amulets. We don't start looking for, you know, shortcuts, because none of those things work. You know, we have to go back to the time tested, proven actions that lead to a favorable outcome. And that's exactly what Lance did. It's like he did not drink the Kool-Aid of trying to do more by either getting too preoccupied and anxious about it that would interrupt his sleep, but he resisted the temptation to try to do too much to get it back too soon, because there's always a massive risk in that. But he held ground, he showed up, he was appreciative to the riders, he assured them that he's doing everything that he can to resurrect. And that's exactly what happened. You know, as we got into the third week of the tour, it always kind of turns around if you don't screw around with it. And it turned around and he went on to win his fifth tour.
So along the way to success, you know, there's a number of steps. You know, it, sometimes, you know, you hear of, you know, business successes that seem to come out of night or out of the blue, or, you know, an athlete that seems to just come out of nowhere. But we all know that there's a lot of steps to move towards greatness. What are the first things that you need to do in order to start creating success?
Well, you have to have the right goal, like we talked about earlier. And then once you have the right goal, then you have to have the right motives, because when you have the right motives and reason for doing it, what that does, it gives you drive, because you have a different reason to get up. And as we talked earlier, that when you've taken the time to look at the impact on your achieved goal, on yourself, on your legacy, on others in the world around you, and you see the virtue of that, then it inspires you to have a purpose to get up and commit to doing what has to go right to achieve that goal. We also talked about making sure you have the right mindset. You know, do you really have what it takes to face the challenges that you're going to face? Let's be real about it. You know, me with my Olympic aspirations, it was like, okay, Jeff, you know, you're giving yourself 10 years to become an Olympian. Well, what happens if you don't become an Olympian? You're responsible for that 10 years. You know, can you actually handle that? Can you actually handle the criticism that you're going to get from your friends about, you know, let's go out and party and stuff like that? Oh, you never drink. You know, you ever tried smoking? Oh, come on, man. You're kidding me. Mr. Goody Two Shoes or whatever. You know, your friends, oh, don't you think you're just full of yourself here? Nobody in our town has ever become an Olympian. What makes you think that you can do it? You know, oh, you're too good for us right now. You never come around and say hello anymore. You know, maybe some members of your family aren't going to like you. You know, I want my Jeff back, you know? So I think we have to really be mindful. Do we have the courage to be able to do what has to go right to honor the calling? And in my opinion, there is no option other than to pursue it, unless you want to, you know, put yourself in the trash can and put a lid on top of it and neuter yourself. I mean, there's no other choice in my mind but to honor whatever that calling is. And that's why we need to be really sure that we have the courage to do what has to go right. And then finally, John, you have to make sure that you have enough resources. I didn't say perfect resources, but you need to have team, you need to have skills, knowledge, you need materials and supplies, you need a map. There's all sorts of things that you need that have to be inventoried that will confirm to you that you can trust your preparation to then actively begin pursuing your goal. So that's what I would suggest.
I love that. Step one. So let's say you've got that all nailed. How do you wake up each day staying engaged and motivated?
Well, first off, you have to understand the path forward. And if you know you have the right goal and you're not motivated, it means that you're not sure what to do next. And that's where sound counsel comes into it, because sometimes we cannot run our blind spots and we can't give ourselves the answer to our next step. That's why we need to have counsel kind of almost on speed dial, where if we get into a jam, we call. Because if you're clear on what the next step is, then you're not going to get up demotivated. You're going to get up motivated because you know what the target is. And so traditionally, the things that need to be clarified to make sure we have the right number of steps and that the intensity of the steps are appropriate. Too few steps with too big of leaps can intimidate the person because they don't really believe that they can do it. So if you trim it back to more smaller steps that are all within reach and you have an appropriate pacing to get through those steps, then it's extraordinarily unlikely that you're going to get up in a place of disbelief that you can do it. So that's what I would recommend.
I love that. There's another concept that you've talked about, and it's the idea of diversity. You know, let's say you look at somebody who's a baseball player, a pitcher, and all they do every day is they wake up and they throw baseballs, they pitch, they pitch, they pitch, they pitch. You've talked about the including things like diversity. I think one of your stories was of a cyclist actually who used to be a violin player and brought in the violin back in. And you talk about how that expands the mind into other areas. So can you talk a little bit about diversity and how that's important to accomplish your goals?
First off, it's important to be mindful that nothing original ever comes out of a Ivy League school. You know, you think Harvard, Yale, that something original is going to come out of there. It doesn't, because there are too many rules that you have to follow to get the brownie button and the approval of the professors and everything else. So, you know, therefore, it's not possible to become your best because there's not enough texture. There's not enough diversity. So what I did with Gavin last year, this was actually a couple of years ago, is that he had a chance to win the national championship, you know, in the pursuit. And it was between, you know, him and some other guys, and the other guys were 8 years older than him. And I said, look, you can't do any more training. You're exhausted. I mean, I didn't create his training program. You know, he worked with somebody that did, but I have enough knowledge to see whether the recovery to the effort and the training load is being paid back. You know, and I said, you're not paying back the debt. You know, it's like to do more, you're just going to get sick or injured. You can't find that elusive 1 or 2% by doing that, but we can look in other places. So I said, you know, you told me about the violin. You hadn't touched it for 10 years. I think if you get it out and you start to play it a little bit, if you can stand the screeching on the violin, I think you'll find that you now are reconnecting with something that was important to you for the first 10 years of your life. And when you talk about, you know, doing a 4K, you know, that's rhythm, that's pacing, it's flow. And when you do that, if you get even 0.5% better because you've opened up another compartment in your brain that you add to that to where you are, that could be the difference between not making the program and a gold medal. And so he kind of took my advice and boom, you know, national champion. So what I have found and through my own experience, as I alluded to in my development, is that, you know, I was a student while I was preparing to become an Olympian. I was a really good student. I also was an artist, and I showed eventually my artwork in the best galleries in New York City. So I worked on that. And remember, we talked about the human mindset versus the champion's mind. The human mindset would say, well, Jeff, you know, you're wasting your time. If you spent more time at cycling, you would be better at it rather than screwing around doing this artwork and going to school, because that's taking away from your preparation. I mean, that's exactly how the human mind works, and the math on that is incredibly faulty. That is absolutely not true. That's a fast way to overexhaust yourself and become neurotic, because you're putting all your eggs in one basket. But as I told Gavin, I said, you know, Gavin, look, you love to read, and why don't you take some courses while you're training to become a member of the national team? Take some college courses. You can go down and you can do them online, which he did, because he was an intellectual sort of guy, you know, and I knew that he could not study. And if he didn't study, he would not be mentally sharp. So that's how we addressed that with him. And so that brought, along with the violin, he's getting maybe 1 or 2% performance from those two particular areas, because his mind was vital. It woke up another side of himself to look at his cycling career in a different way. It took up some time, so he got a better recovery from training on the bike, you know, versus these other things. So again, diversity is the name of the game. You're not going to become better by spending more time in what you're already doing. We need another perspective. Nothing original, nothing that's truly unique ever comes from a traditional path. It's always some guy that brings something from somewhere into what he's doing that sees things differently, that creates the distinction. It's exactly the same thing for us.
I really can't agree with that more. I try my best to diversify myself as much as possible, because I do believe that it brings in insight from so many different areas. You can be listening to one thing completely unrelated to what you do, and you find the next minute that you can actually apply something that you've learned from that area. Yeah, I love it. I love that. I think it leads perfectly into a transition in here to talking about the idea of perfectionism and making yourself perfect, whether it be a product, whether it be a certain PR, before you feel that you're ready. What are your thoughts on perfection?
Well, I think we need to have aspirational goals to test ourselves against the presumption, because when we do that and we fail, well, that just is an indicator where we are. But if we succeed all the time or we don't do that, then we carry a low-level anxiety with us all the time, because we don't know what the edges of our box are, and we don't know how hard we can push. We don't know our limits. So I feel like, again, we kind of need to build failure into our life. You almost have to schedule it so that we can get a sense of where we really are. And you'll find that when you do that, you're not going to die. I mean, I had an athlete when I was working with athletes, and I knew that he was investing too much in his aspiration to be perfect that was actually hurting him, because he was too tight trying to be too perfect. He was trying to control things too much. You know, he had a death grip on the steering wheel. He just wasn't fluid. So I had him, you know, go do this lift where, you know, he put, you know, it was 250 pounds Olympic bar, and I wanted to kind of do a clean from the floor with that weight, which would be impossible for him to do. And he knew it. And he kind of looked at me when I said, yeah, go ahead, let's go. Like, are you kidding? I said, no, let's go. And so he went over there and he couldn't lift it, right? And he came back at me. It looked at me like I'm failed. I said, what'd you learn there? He said, well, I failed. And what else did you learn? Well, I didn't die. I said, well, that's good. That's what I want you to understand. You're not going to die. Okay. It's okay.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So that's my feeling. And the reality of this is, John, is that you're more likely to put in the perfect performance when you kind of stop caring, like it's during the week and you don't care, you know? And yeah. So if you kind of give yourself permission to be a little bit less tight, like at the Tour de France, like when we would show up for a day's stage, we would show up, you know, fairly casually. We were crisp in our movements and everything, but we weren't frantic, you know? And people from the outside said, man, you guys are, God, it's a little too casual, isn't it? You know, this is a Tour de France, man. You guys should be more serious. Look at those guys over there. You know, wrenches were flying. We were yelling at each other. It's like, man, those guys are taking it seriously. You guys are, you know, like you just got up from a nap or something. But, you know, what we knew is that we'd already done the homework, so the test is going to be easy. And so if you prepare well, then you don't need to worry about the perfection because it's going to come because your mind is agile and your body's more rested. You're performing more in real time rather than perceived time. So I think the aspiration of perfection is okay. But I feel like you need counsel to give yourself permission to find the elusive 1 or 2% by getting it. You know, look, 90% is still an A in a class, right? And one of the things I learned from graduate school when I was there is that I'd show up and all the students would be huddled around the door waiting for the professor to open up. And then when he'd open it up, but all the students were quizzing each other, right? When he, you know, they were looking at their, frantically looking at their notes and, you know, scanning through the chapters and all that stuff. And what I realized was as an Olympian is that the closer you get to performing, the less you prepare, the less you think. You know, you want to let your mind and body kind of peak and you want to put your trust in your preparation to let what you know you can do execute itself when it had to go right. But I realized people were putting 100% of their confidence in the 5% they didn't know. And so at the end of the test, they were erasing all their answers, changing all the right ones to wrong answers. And then we went out in the hall, everybody's crying because they blew it. You know, I wasn't going to do it this time. I can't believe I did it again, you know.
The preparation, it makes me think of a story of actually, when I went, it's funny because I, you know, like you say, you're trying to be diverse. I was reading this book on mnemonics again, which is again how I ended up learning about Jim Quick. But in this book that I was reading, they're talking about the learning a card deck at speed. So if you can remember the order of the card deck, and in America, there was a guy who had broken the record, and then after him, there was a guy who came out and beat him. I think it was the next year. And when you're doing that in competition, a lot of the guys use like earplugs. They have like sort of like a blindfold, so they don't have any peripheral vision and everything's silent, and that's how they train and that's how they practice. So when they get the competition, they're ready to repeat these cards of decks really quickly. And so the guy that beat this guy the year after, I think he was trained by David Goggins. I think it was Goggins who helped him get over it and trained for this. And he said, well, how do they compete? And he said, well, you know, we put these, you know, headphones or earplugs in and we do all this sort of stuff. He goes, well, that's not how we're going to train. He goes, well, how are we going to train? He goes, I'm going to put you underwater with a snorkel on and we're going to play music in the pool and you're going to have to memorize it that way. And he's like, why on earth would we do that? And he said, because by the time you get there, it's going to be easy. You're not going to have all these other distractions. You're going to be so prepared for this that you're going to win. And the guy won. He like beat the record by like an amazing amount. I just thought that was a fascinating story. It reminded me when you're saying the guys were throwing wrenches around because they're so...
Man, they're taking it so seriously. Look at those guys, man. They're going to kill these guys, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I love that. Oh, goodness. So I think another thing, sometimes if we jump into things a little bit too quickly, we can find ourselves underprepared. Do you have any tests to make sure that we're not underprepared or we're kind of at that spot where we're ready to actually take the step to accomplish our goal?
Well, the champion's golden rule is do the homework and the test is easy. At least that's my version of it. And we should be able to, whatever we can duplicate in practice and in training, we should be able to duplicate and then some in competition. And that's why our preparation needs to be calibrated so that we have evidence of the fact that we can do it. There has to be tangible evidence. It's not about thinking your way to a place that you haven't demonstrated your ability to get to. You know, that's garbage. That's a recipe for disaster. You know, there has to be something that you can hang on to, that you can believe in, that has already told you what you're capable of, you know, plus some. And that's, again, why I'm a real stickler. Let's make sure that the preparation is what it needs to be. Like when I was working with U2, helping them prepare for a world tour, they prepared in a stadium exactly like they would be performing in the 131 venues over the next 18 months. And they performed exactly their sets at the time that they would be going on. And they would be doing full dress rehearsals all the time so that there were no surprises. So when they stepped onto stage, oh, I've been here, you know, and that's the way that we need to make sure that we prepare ourselves. And in that way, it's a guarantee that you'll put your best effort forward.
Love it. On the way to success and all the steps you take, you can hit some roadblocks and plateaus. What are your best recommendations for when somebody hits some of those plateaus?
First, many of the plateaus can be anticipated. And I think it's important that when we hit plateaus, some of this needs to be anticipated, because in any aspirational goal, there is generally a place that I call the daily grind. And this is where you're showing up day in and day out, and you're just not feeling like you're getting anything close back to what you deserve from the time and effort that you're putting into it. And this is a time where people, given enough opportunity, if they start letting their mind control their thinking, will most likely quit. But the reality of this is that it's supposed to be hard. This is where you're fine-tuning your presumptions about what you perceive or did perceive in your planning the process to be, but now it's facing reality. And as it's facing reality, you're making course corrections and you're toughening yourself up both mentally and physically to be able to acquire the skills now that you realize you have to have and the things that are required to manifest what it is you have aspirations towards. And unfortunately, sometimes when people get there, they start to prophesize, well, you know, I can't do this because now it's tough. It was not a good choice. You know, I chose this on the other side. You know, or maybe the universe is conspiring against me. I mean, all sorts of ideas pop into the brain in situations like that. You know, and all of these are, again, human nature trying to talk us out of it. And so if you clearly recognize this, and if you're not sure, that's where the corner man comes into it. You know, you need someone to clarify for you that which you can't clarify. You don't want to waste any unnecessary energy on that. You want to make sure that you know what it is and that you stay in the game long enough, because what I can assure you, this was my process to become an Olympian. I gave myself 10 years, and I remember, it took me 9 years of facing the boogeyman day in and day out, you know, with the peaks and valleys of training and the successes and the failures, to develop the capacity to get to a point where I actually knew I could do it. And, you know, there's one thing to have an aspirational goal with initial enthusiasm to pursue, but like all honeymoons, they all wear off and there's always going to be a dead zone there. And you just have to know that that's coming. So if you know that there is a honeymoon over moment and you know what that means and you interpret it correctly, then you stay in the game. Then you continue to build critical mass. And what I can promise you is that one day, if you're doing the right thing and you have the confirmation of that because you've had somebody come in and look at it, if that's necessary, that you're going to get up and you're going to believe that you could do it. You get up one day, look, if Jeff can do it, then I can do it, you know? And once you have that moment, then it's almost like game over, because then you have belief, and belief goes a long way. You just need to kind of take belief and make that knowing, and then it's literally game over. It's just a matter of time.
As far as your list of things that you need to accomplish in order to become a champion, a lot of times we put deadlines and timelines on things, but sometimes we don't quite hit that deadline or timeline. What is your recommendation for that? If the list of items that you're looking at, you're not able to hit them in the order or the timeline that you want, how do you adjust for that?
Well, I think it comes with a responsible look at the timeline and how it was established, because in the present moment, while we're making plans for the future, we're making plans on what our assumption life will be like en route from now to then, and a lot can happen. And so if we make sure that we are kind of adjusting our scorecard, and my scorecard is not, are you drawing lines through your to-do list? I mean, that's a recipe for just feeling like crap every day, because you're never going to be able to, you may have once in a millennia a good day on that one. But as I was telling one of my clients today, I said, you know, that's not your scorecard. Your scorecard is, did you adapt appropriately to the unforeseen circumstances that arose? And if you adjusted and adapted appropriately, then you get an A. If you huffed and puffed because you said you were going to do something and you ended up saying some things to people that hurt their feelings and you failed to do what you had to do for yourself and now you're sick, well, you get an F. Yeah, I know, but I crossed the line off the list. You got an F because you didn't show the professional restraint that every prolific achiever should show if they're going to learn the lesson in the process of consistent goal achievement. So I think the scorecard's got to be different. I feel that, you know, as General Patton said, your plan's only as good until it meets the enemy. Then you make the adjustments as you go, and that's your scorecard.
Okay, awesome. Let's talk about after you hit your goal. So one of the things you talked about in your podcast is often your best day leads to your worst year.
Yeah. It's
okay. You should talk about that a little bit because I thought that was interesting when I first heard that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking this, the guy that won the Tour de France last year, a 22-year-old, amazing rider, came back and had to quit the Tour this year. And that's not, I mean, to me, that's more predicted, you know, like it's like the rainbow jersey jinx, you know, you win the world championship and then your next year is going to be terrible. Well, that's because all the dynamics change because, you know, once you have a great year, then you start looking at things a lot differently. You know, sometimes you become too domesticated, you know, you kind of lost the hunter gatherer, you know, primal caveman instincts in Spartan living style, where you start to get a little bit too comfortable with stuff, or the phone rings too much and now you're getting all sorts of requests for time and things like that that could be used better to duplicate what you just did by ensuring your recovery. So things do change a lot. So I feel that it's really important that we be mindful about how we got from where we are to here and what were the things that went right to make that happen and what are some of the things that could be improved in moving forward. And what are some of the pitfalls that people traditionally fall subject to that make the general rule that your best year leads to then a much worse year the next time? And to me, that's sound counsel. Like I helped this guy win a gold medal in the Olympics, right? Yeah. And so I was talking with one of his advisors who was telling me what he was doing. And I'm saying, what is he thinking? Somebody needs to talk to him. I mean, this is disaster in the making. Because I've seen it a million times. Of course, he didn't pay attention to anybody because he thought that he'd arrived and he could do whatever he wanted. So that led to disaster. So again, sound counsel that can help you point out what's coming so that you don't leave a string of preventable problems in the wake of a severely stalled career.
Yep. And how do you use your success to help others once you've accomplished that goal?
Well, I think the fact that you've done it serves as a case study for people to observe. And I think that we can play a more active role in that by being an advocate for others and being available appropriately to be able to share what you learned about the process to help others shortcut their path to their bigger future. You know, Lance has got this thing called the survivor's obligation, meaning that, you know, he survived literally a death sentence, cancer diagnosis. And he felt a tremendous obligation to the cancer community because he survived it to contribute back to it. That's why he created Live Strong and you know, some of the other things that he did. And I've seen him do some amazing acts of charity that people, I think, would be shocked to see because of that. And I do believe that part of how we pay back the debt for the good fortune is to make sure that we help shortcut other people's path to their bigger future by sharing with them those things that we found valuable to us that allow us to get to our goals faster, to amass an impressive list of accomplishments that will create a lasting legacy that people can learn from.
I love that, Jeff. These are great answers to some really difficult questions to answer. And I just want to ask you a couple general questions for our listeners. If people want to learn more about you and what you do, what's the best way for them to get information?
Well, thank you. You know, we've talked about a variety of different things today. So a couple things here. I would say that, you know, I have a model that I've created called the Goal Achievement Roadmap. that kind of goes through the process, which I've observed into over the last 50 years on, you know, what it is that the prolific achievers know that most people don't, to be able to consistently and predictably and repeatedly achieve their goals. And then there's also a paper that I put together called How Not to Blow It Just Before You Win. And that's a real, real classic scenario in athletics. And people can get that PDF by going to beforeyouwin.com, beforeyouwin.com. You can go there and get that white paper. Please take the time to do that. You'll find it invaluable. And while you're waiting for that, it will take you to a video that shares with you some of the things that I've done to help my clients become perennial peak performers. That would be one way to do it. You know, certainly you can go to my website, drjeffspencer.com. If you're interested in having a more in-depth conversation and you have high aspirations for yourself, you can certainly fill out an application. I'll get it. And there's the possibility of us having a conversation and see how we might be able to shortcut your path to your bigger future.
And that's your coaching aspect of your business, right? That's you working one-on-one with somebody.
Yes, or one-on-one to small group, yes. And any other reason, you know, to come in and do a one-day, half-day deal for a business or an executive team or anything like that. Yep. Or even to do something for, like, let's say it's an award ceremony or something along those lines, you know, 1 hour keynotes or something I'm also very passionate about.
Okay. So we have a question that we ask every guest on the podcast, regardless of what their expertise is. And I think you'll have a very interesting answer to this. We call it our what point question. And so we base it on a cyclist who's, you know, they're not off the couch. They've got some training behind them. They have a 300 watt FTP. And if they were to take the advice of the expert on the show, how many watts do you think that that would add to their FTP after, you know, going through a plan to implement the advice that you've given?
Well, I would say that you could increase that probably, I'm going to say conservatively, whatever that is, just by picking one thing out of what I said there. If you just apply the one thing that has to go right that you heard me say, I mean, that will improve anything easily 10% or more, for sure. Because usually we have one block that gets in the way. And if we can identify what that block is and we can get rid of it, then that unlocks just a tremendous amount of potential. And you may find that it actually improves it, you know, more than that. You know, may give you, I don't know, 500 watts, who knows?
Yep, I love it. Well, thank you very much for being on the show today. Yeah, you've been an excellent guest. And I'm just happy we had the time to sit down and chat.
Me too, John.
All right, take care. Thanks for listening to Faster. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Leave a review or teach a friend what you learned today. For more great episodes on getting faster, subscribe to this podcast. While you're on your next ride, be kind to one another and ride safe.